Surprise birthdays are kind of a dangerous idea.
Why?
Like, who says I'm, like, ready to go do something with a bunch of people when I had other plans?
Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Last week, Vice President Joe Biden flipped his position on the Hyde Amendment, a law that bans federal funding of abortions in most cases. He initially defended his support for the amendment, but then on Thursday said he had changed his mind. So we're going to discuss why he changed his position and what it tells us about the Democratic primary and the party overall. We're also going to talk about Elizabeth Warren. If you've been reading the news or watching cable TV over the past week or so, you may have heard that she is gaining traction based on the breadth of her policy proposals. So is that showing up in the polls, and are voters really reacting to her policies? Here with me to dig into all of that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
It's going well. Thank you, Galen.
And also with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire, how are you?
What's up?
And Micah is out today, but he will be back with us next week. So to start, why did Biden change his position on the Hyde Amendment last week?
Because he was getting criticized by people he wants to be in his coalition.
Yeah.
Groups like NARAL.
NARAL.
Biden has, I think, to some extent, on some past issues, demonstrated that actually he is kind of in touch with the median or mainstream Democratic voter in a way that maybe some people in the media didn't understand. They kind of overestimated how far left the Democratic Party had gone, the average
voter.
Or maybe
even some candidates, apart from just the media.
Some candidates, too. However, abortion is not one of those issues. Abortion is not something where, like, only, oh, the fringe kind of one-quarter leftmost part of the Democratic Party feels a certain way about abortion. I mean, there is a mix of opinions. But this is a big kind of issue where he was out of step with not universal, but probably mainstream Democratic opinion. And he's kind of saying, I don't know if transactional is the right word, but, like, you know, I'm here to, like, kind of represent the Democratic Party and be kind of a, frankly, like a generic Democrat.
Well, he didn't literally say that. And I think he's probably trying to make it seem like he's not being transactional. But yeah, that's how you're reading it.
By the way, there's nothing wrong with transactional politics. I mean, I think one of the stupidest notions in political analysis is the notion that, like, in a representative democracy, that it's bad if a politician flip-flops to adapt to their constituents' preferences, right? You know, it's so weird to me that it's seen as, oh my gosh, right?
Well, it gets to this question of authenticity.
Well,
right?
we're going to talk a lot today, I think, about media narratives, why they take hold, whether or not they should mean anything, do mean anything. I mean, I think for Biden and abortion, he hasn't run for president in a while. I also think that on this particular...
It's like a funny thing to say.
No, I know, but it's true, right?
He hasn't run for president in a while.
He hasn't campaigned since 2012, right, mm-hmm. on a presidential ticket. And I also think for Biden, abortion is probably a particular, I guess, blind spot, right, for lack of a better phrase. In part because I do actually think it has some complicated personal feelings about abortion and, you know, his reticence to sort of say he won't support the Hyde Amendment anymore probably does actually have a lot to do with, I would guess, maybe some personal gut reaction to not wanting to see as many abortions happen in the United States. I think what's interesting about the new Democratic position on abortion, it has a lot to do with, you know, we saw a lot of coverage in the past few weeks about this Alabama law in particular, and the idea that Democrats feel as if abortion is so much more threatened in so many states. And it is, right? There are lots of, I think there's something like six states now with a single clinic left that performs abortions. And I think, you know, when you're reading some of the coverage of the arguments that people say convinced Biden to make a switch, it was people arguing, listen, you know, you and Barack Obama pushed a healthcare law that aimed to give people greater access to healthcare. The Hyde Amendment disproportionately affects people who rely on government assistance for healthcare, i.e., you're putting the screws to the people that your healthcare law was supposed to help. So I think that's, you know, that's kind of what's sort of trickling out probably from his campaign about, like, the reason for the switch. But I would say that Biden probably does have a lot of personal history. I mean, he's a man of a certain age and a certain generation of Catholicism, and I think that makes a big difference.
I mean, this is an issue on which the average, not Democratic voter, but the average general election voter probably supports the Hyde Amendment. The 2016 Harvard Public Health /Politico poll showed that 58% of Americans oppose changing the current policy in order to allow Medicaid funds to be used to pay for abortions. among Democratic likely voters in the 2016 election, 55% favored the change, 37% opposed. So this is an issue where Democrats are, as of 3 years ago, and if anything, probably the party has shifted a bit to the left on abortion, Democrats are in favor of it by a solid but not overwhelming margin of removing the Hyde Amendment, whereas the general population, independents, probably preferred keeping the Hyde Amendment. And so, you know, Biden was, I think, trying to kind of fairly carefully calibrate, like, okay, can I do something that's slightly unpopular among Democrats to avoid something which is fairly unpopular with the general election? And the answer from kind of interest groups and activists was no, this is a big deal. You have to kind of get on the bus, right? And it's not acceptable for you to have this position. And he listened to them, right? And there were kind of reports about how, like, younger staffers were personally pressing the urgency of this and saying, hey, look, we understand the Democratic primary electorate pretty well, and this is kind of something where you have to, like, actually change your position, because this one is a big deal. This is not just kind of left-wing media chatter or whatever else. This is a kind of very core issue that's important to people who turn out reliably in primaries and caucuses.
So what is the Democratic Party position on abortion? Is there one clear position on it? Is there still a range of possibilities that Democrats can take when they're running for office?
Well, I think obviously we're seeing that it's this. It's that you have to be pretty liberal on abortion. I think the more interesting question is kind of what happens in a general election with abortion. Obviously, Biden, as Nate said, maybe had a bit of an eye towards the general election with this view. If you're Republican strategists, I'm sure you're watching this particular dust up and saying, oh, well, here's a general election, you know, weakness, basically, right, for Biden. But I do think that because of, as I said before, because of the rapidity at which a lot of these clinics are closing, there is a sense of urgency. And, you know, groups like NARAL and Planned Parenthood do have quite a bit of political clout, fundraising clout in the Democratic Party. So those are voices that are listened to. And I think you're seeing that. And I think all of the candidates, pretty much all the Democratic candidates, pretty much have the same position on abortion now, give or take.
So I'm going to read Biden's characterization of his position on abortion as of 2007, according to his book from that year titled Promises to Keep. And I'm curious if you think, apart from just the Hyde Amendment, if this is a tenable position for a Democratic politician today. He writes, quote, "My position is that I am personally opposed to abortion, but I don't think I have the right to impose my view on the rest of society. I've thought a lot about it, and my position probably doesn't please anyone." He goes on to say, "I've stuck to my middle-of-the-road position on abortion for more than 30 years. I still vote against partial birth abortion and federal funding, and I'd like to make it easier for scared young mothers to choose not to have an abortion, but I will also vote against a constitutional amendment that strips a woman of her right to make her own choice." I know Tim Kaine in 2016 said, you know, as a Catholic, I'm personally pro-life, but also kind of globally pro-choice. Is that still a position that a Democrat can take in the party today?
Well, I think, by the way, you know, I think I said before that they probably all have about the same positions. I mean, if Biden still opposes third trimester abortions, then I think that there are some Democratic candidates who have a different stance on him than that.
To me, that seems like a very kind of mainstream argument that you might hear all the time, right? That personally, I think abortion is not so great, but it's up to women to decide. And clearly, you know, women get to make the choice. I mean, that seems like that's why the pro-choice movement brands itself as pro-choice, right? It's saying that you can be personally opposed to a lot of things and not want to outlaw them.
But has that always been a politically convenient argument? That you can still appeal to social conservatives by saying, well, I'm like personally opposed to it, but I don't want to like legislate my beliefs. Whereas in many other forms of issues, I do want to legislate my beliefs.
I think that there's some logical dissonance there. I think what is probably the view of a lot of regular Americans, not politicians, who hold that view of like, I'm kind of uncomfortable with it, but okay with it being legal. I honestly think it's probably that people have some sense of a fetus in the first trimester is very different from a fetus in the third trimester. So it's almost a spectrum of when do the rights of this baby equal or supersede the mother's, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that's an uncomfortable, though more logical, viewpoint to express in the political arena.
And we've talked about this in the past on the podcast as well, and that shows up in the polling. You can literally see, as you ask people about first, second, and third trimesters, people's opinions change significantly from
right.
one to the next.
But I think it's politics, right? There's a lot of, and particularly around abortion and the way that, you know, you can even look at the way Roe v. Wade was argued, right? A lot of people you know, on the liberal side of things are unhappy with the arguments that the initial Roe decision was decided on. So I think there's a lot of interesting, like, around abortion stuff. It has become pretty shrouded by, there are these pat political phrases that have kind of, I'm sure they've been poll tested, right? That's how we recognize a moderate stance. What was the Clinton era?
Safe, legal, and rare.
Right. Yeah. Which I believe Hillary Clinton voiced at various points, although with the sort of modern, I actually think the biggest change in the way that the Democratic Party talks about abortion is it's moved from the sort of 80s, 90s, almost like religious conversation to framing it as a healthcare issue, framing it as a minority, framing it as a discrimination issue. And I think that that's probably maybe has something to do with the slight edging up of the numbers of people who want it to be legal in that on the Democratic primary electorate side.
You know, maybe it's difficult to tell from looking at the polling, but are Democrats actually changing their mind on this issue, or are activists just becoming more motivated and activated by the issue?
I mean, look, I mean, almost every issue, things have become more polarized. And you obviously see Republicans in certain states passing very restrictive abortion bills that will probably be struck down by the courts, maybe lead to a court challenge of Roe v. Wade in the long run. So, yeah, obviously, I mean, I guess, like, partisanship kind of dominates everything else in politics. And the most important trend in American politics the past 30 years, I don't know how far back you want to date it, is increasing partisanship and polarization. So even in a case like abortion, where the influence of the religious right is maybe less than it was before, that still is kind of overwhelmed by partisanship. The debate about the Hyde Amendment in particular, though, is, as you guys have been saying, it does get into questions of, like, people who are poor, who would actually be on Medicaid and who would not necessarily have another way to pay for an abortion through private insurance or whatever else. And so it does potentially affect people who are, again, remember, Biden's voters, he's overperforming with black voters relative to white voters. He's overperforming with working class voters relative to college educated voters. And so you have kind of a congruence on the one hand of, like, elite Democratic opinion is against the Hyde Amendment, but also his constituents, people who might be in his core constituency, I should say, would also be affected by it. And so it's a pretty material issue.
Although, interestingly, if you look at the upshot over the weekend, dug up a bunch of polling on this, amongst African-American Democrats, they're split 50-50 on whether or not abortion should be legal in all cases. So yeah, that was actually the most conservative group amongst Democrats on the issue.
Yeah.
So that kind of aligns with the coalition that Biden seems to be putting together.
Black voters are also tend to be more religious, right? So that I think that that's also playing in here, right? That people who are, you know, regular churchgoers tend to be more split on the abortion issue.
So far, part of the narrative of Biden's success in the polls up till now has been all of the activists that you hear from on Twitter, they're not the party. And Biden, and this is at least what his advisors will tell the press, you know, Biden is really more in touch with your median Democratic voter than Twitter thinks he is. And, you know, that's being proven through the polls. Does this change that equation? That maybe as we go through this primary, there are going to be more places where he is out of step? Or is this a one-off thing?
No, I mean, there might be other things. You just have to. So one, I think that might be a good candidate is potentially marijuana legalization, where Biden has stated more conservative stances than where the Democratic Party is, or frankly, maybe than the country as a whole. But this is not rocket science. You just have to look at the polls and say, okay, what do Democrats actually think about some of these things? You know, on the question of, like, how do Democrats feel about the term socialism versus capitalism? You know, it's still, like, that's a lot different than you might get from the media chatter. But on this issue, again, by about an 18 or 20 point margin as of 2016, Democrats were in favor of removing the Hyde Amendment. And so, you know, in some sense, it's very straightforward. And the question was, could this be like a kind of low salience issue that Biden could kind of get a pass on and then it helps him, however marginally, in the general electorate? You know, the answer is no, that abortion is too important. So, I mean, to me, this all seems like kind of normal. And it's a little bit weird that people are framing it as like, oh, here's a gaffe, right? I mean, I think people on the left should be happy that their candidate is that a candidate is responsive to them saying, hey, look, sorry, bud, this is one where you got to get her back.
I do think that there's a bit of a weird, there's been some weird coverage of, like, the Biden campaign in the past week besides the Hyde stuff. I mean, so there was a, like, I think Vox first wrote about this, that they said that the Biden campaign website had what they were calling plagiarized sections, you know, basically policy plan stuff that appeared on advocacy groups' websites. And the, you know, the line that was drawn was Biden famously plagiarized in his first presidential campaign the story of a British politician. But to me, Biden didn't write his campaign website. And while it might be sort of potentially like sloppy, policy advocacy groups do want presidential campaigns to adopt their policies. But the way it was turned into this narrative in the media was very fascinating to me. You know, Biden plus plagiarism equals click. But just to go back to, you know, other issues where that might come up throughout the course of the campaign that people will say Biden is out of step with the Democratic base. I think it's going to be interesting to watch how he might handle those things. As Nate says, maybe marijuana will come up as a cultural touchstone. I think one thing that we've talked about over and over again is how much the Democratic primary electorate wants someone to beat Donald Trump, right? And so perhaps Biden's campaign, I don't know, I'm just spitballing, says, listen, we understand that there's a spectrum of belief on this in the Democratic Party, re-marijuana legalization or anything else. But we think a lot of Americans, many of whom were trying to win their vote, we need to meet them where they're at right now and convince them, right? We need to wage a persuasion campaign, and we're just not there right now. Like, I'm kind of curious about how Biden frames those issues that he's more conservative on than the Democratic primary electorate, but he's in step with the general American electorate, or more specifically, to be frank, the electorates of certain states that the Democrats need to win in order to win the presidency, because that's the way it works in the Electoral College.
So we mentioned marijuana in the New York Times telling of this story. They also brought up the environment as an area where Biden had kind of evolved from an advisor saying that he would find a middle path on climate change or something like that. Activists within the party were like, well, that's not acceptable. And then he put out a climate proposal. Are there any other things that we can kind of imagine looking ahead to the rest of this primary?
Well, I think someone, you know, Amy Klobuchar's response when she was asked during, I think, a CNN town hall, do you believe in free college, right? And she said, no, you know, I don't want to give people false hope. So no. So I think certain things, there are other candidates in the field who are cutting this pragmatist track, which is like, listen, of course, I would love to do this. I like the ideas put forth, but no, that's not a tenable plan where we are right now. So I think you could also, I mean, you know, Klobuchar is obviously taking a certain kind of like, I'm the pragmatic woman in the race, right? I'm not, this isn't pie in the sky. I'm telling you what we can accomplish right now. Kind of the Democratic straight talk express sort of thing.
Right. And I mean, if you listen to what Biden's staffers are saying, you know, they've told the press, like, we don't want this to be an apology tour. You know, their plan is for him to be somewhat bold in on his history in some spaces where he may not perfectly align with the left of the party today. I'm curious about how this all plays out in the general election, potentially. I'm sure everyone remembers from 2012, Romney had plenty of similar experiences where he was judged at points as not conservative enough and then went pretty far to the right on several issues. One of his advisors...
Self-deportation.
Yes. One of his advisors ended up saying in an interview, you know, we'll shake him up like an Etch-a-Sketch for the general election. And then that was widely panned. So what kind of vulnerabilities are there involved in flip-flopping, I guess, on positions like this?
There's definitely a vulnerability. I guess Mitt Romney wasn't, I don't think, as well known as Joe Biden is, right? When he ran for president in 2012, he was a bit of like the consensus candidate. Biden, I think, does, there's certainly risks. I'm not saying that. Like, people certainly, I think, you know, per the success of Bernie Sanders in 2016, and as we're going to talk about perhaps the success of Elizabeth Warren or burgeoning success, is that there are people who take stances and you just know what their stance is. I think Joe Biden is just super well known, associated with this kind of now golden haze, halcyon Obama era for Democrats. And that's kind of that's what he's going for. The people will remember the good vibrations of that.
All these era. Sound like good vibrations, golden haze. They all sound like strains of marijuana, ironically enough.
Okay, so Nate, what's your take on the risks involved in changing your position to meet the activists where they are as you go through a primary in comparison to the kind of campaign you want to run or your chances in a general election?
Look, I mean, there are people who disagree. I think the evidence mostly says that if you're closer to the center or whatever that is, then that probably is helpful for you electorally. So if you're kind of shifting to the left, and we know on this issue in particular, the majority of Americans, as of a couple of years ago, supported the Hyde Amendment. So he is, you know, at the margin, it probably hurts him in the general election. I tend to think it's going to be a little hard for Biden to be branded as like this crazy liberal, in part because he is like a old white man, right? And to some extent, I mean, there are exceptions like abortion and marijuana. But for the most part, he has pretty mainstream policies that are kind of very similar to the policies that President Obama had and that Hillary Clinton had when she was running 4 years ago. And he's kind of routinely described in media accounts as being a moderate. And I wonder if that's really accurate. You know, if you kind of look at his voting record as a member of the Senate, he is always kind of exactly in the middle of the Democratic caucus. And so as Democrats move left gradually, not as much in that period as Republicans moved right, but he kind of shifts along with them and tax, like he's kind of seen, he's kind of a moderate, right? But I don't know. I would describe the Democrats as like a liberal party, maybe not a party of the left, but a liberal party, certainly. And Biden is kind of the average Democrat, and therefore he should probably be thought of as a liberal. And you want to call him moderate, it's maybe in relative terms, but I don't know.
I think that's probably the right way to frame it, but then this is where the media narrative comes in, right?
Well, right, because the same thing could have been said, perhaps, about Mitt Romney, is that he was a conservative Republican. He just wasn't conservative enough for the Tea Party in that era. And as he started to align his positions more and more with the Tea Party, he developed the media develop a narrative about him not being authentic, right? And so is that a risk for Biden, I guess, is the question in this case.
Yes.
I don't know.
I think it's naive for us to sit here and say that a media narrative won't have some effect. You know, I've listened to countless, like, you know, talk shows or read like little articles or tweets where people are, I think, kind of subtly sort of anti-Biden. Or not anti-Biden in the sense of like, oh, this is a gaffe or something like this. I think some of that is driven by the fact that he does not do as many public events as other candidates. And so maybe as a reporter, there's a bit of like, come on. We have lots of access. We have lots of, you know, footage of these other people kind of like interacting, doing these town halls, whatever. And we've had it since January or whenever the first person got in.
And him winning would be a boring story.
Yeah.
So Biden entered the race April 25th. And so we've had 6 weeks now, 7 weeks of kind of gets a big polling lead. Now it's probably fading a bit. We can talk about that in the Elizabeth Warren part of this. But it's been a pretty boring time. And so I think the media wants a shift in narrative. I do think, by the way, the first debate is therefore a moment of vulnerability for him, because sometimes like those are ways to shift the narrative. And to some extent, if Biden's ahead of everyone by 15 points, there's not that much else to talk about, right? If it's a closer race and all of a sudden who's in second and third and fourth matters a lot more.
Or everyone's coming at him at the debate.
Or everyone comes at him at the debate, although that can look desperate too. And the first debate in 2015, I guess it was, helped bolster, at least temporarily, Hillary Clinton's lead over Bernie Sanders. But look, I do kind of wonder half the time if like, half the time when you kind of hear the media narrative, oh, Biden is kind of too moderate for the Democratic Party, I wonder if there are some voters who actually think, oh, that sounds pretty good to me, right? Including people that like are participating in polls of the general election. And one of Biden's obviously big arguments is his kind of electability. So that is the other trade-off, right? That like, if you are taking a stance that is potentially unpopular with general election voters, it's not just that it might actually hurt you in the general election. It's also that he benefits every time CNN comes out with a poll showing Biden's beating Trump by 8. I don't think people should spend a lot of time looking at those polls, but they do because they don't listen to this podcast enough.
Tell your friends.
But there is a perception that Biden is more electable, which is bolstered by these general election polls. And so in a weird way, that stuff probably matters to him more than a candidate like a Warren, who is campaigning on being the ideas person.
All right. Well, with that, let's move on to talk about Elizabeth Warren and whether she's gaining traction on the strength of her policy proposals. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. WeWork designs flexible workspace for businesses of all sizes and industries. WeWork spaces are designed to maximize workplace efficiency, employee effectiveness, team collaboration, and creativity. It's the perfect solution for medium, large, and enterprise businesses that intend to expand into new cities and continents with ease. Looking for an office with a view of Lima, London, Melbourne, or Mumbai? WeWork now has over 400 locations in 100 different cities worldwide. Membership plans are completely flexible, and workspaces are designed to grow with your team. Floor mapping technology is used to build out custom private floors for larger teams and perfectly designed to fit your business's continuously evolving needs. WeWork pays special attention to the culture and energy in each of their locations, designed to foster amazing partnerships and collaborations both within teams and across companies. Head over to WeWork.com to find a location near you or learn more about WeWork's custom workspace solutions for larger teams. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Upstart. Getting into debt is easy. Getting out of debt is hard, especially if your FICO score isn't great. Thankfully, now there's Upstart.com, the revolutionary lending platform that offers smarter interest rates to help pay off high-interest credit card debt. Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter interest rate. Upstart believes you're more than just your credit score. The best part, once the loan is approved, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 200,000 people have used Upstart to pay off student loans or to make a large purchase. Free yourself from the burden of debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes and it won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/politics. All right, a popular narrative has emerged in the Democratic primary contest. Here are a couple headlines from the past few weeks. The New York Times says, quote, Elizabeth Warren gains ground in the 2020 field, one plan at a time. Bloomberg says, Elizabeth Warren rises in the 2020 race as policy focus catches fire. The Washington Post says, Warren's nonstop ideas reshape the Democratic presidential race and give her new momentum. So, first of all, are these accurate? Is Elizabeth Warren breaking through?
Maybe. Let's start.
Tell me more.
Let's start with the national picture, which is a bit hard to make the case with the national polls, I suppose. So, Real Clear Politics, we will at some point this summer have a 538 average, but these guys do fine work. So she's currently at 8% in the RCP average, which is actually down from a few weeks ago, which was 10%. But I wouldn't call that a significant move. It's up from like 6% before Biden announced his candidacy. And so she's gained a little bit. She's the one candidate, apart from Joe Biden, to have moved up in this kind of post-Biden environment. But again, going from 6 to 10 and then back to 9 or whatever, if you look at the same pollster, some Morning Consult, I think they actually don't have that moving up and down, right? The Chevrolet kind of moving up gradually. But like, so look, this is not a Herman Cain
style rise to popularity.
Or even a Buttigiegian
rise, yeah.
Rise, right? But she's doing a little better
warranted.
Than she was. It's warranted. In Iowa, though, you can start to make an argument that like you've seen more tangible signs of a surge, most notably the CNN Des Moines Register Seltzer and Company / poll, Selzer, which is a very good poll. Seltzer this weekend had Warren at 15%, basically in a three-way tie with Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg for second place, with Biden at a less formidable 24%. If you kind of go through and look at favorability ratings in the polls, and actually quite a few polls, she gets higher ratios of favorable to unfavorable ratios than Bernie Sanders does, or than most or than many other candidates. Joe Biden's are pretty good. Kamala Harris is pretty good, but she's moved up in that department, right? If you look at polls of the group she would need to win, so there are a lot of polls now that show her beating Sanders among liberals, beating Sanders among voters who are being more attentive to the campaign. So I don't know what to say. I think I think for some of the same reasons we were talking about a moment ago with Biden, right? The media would love for there to be some dynamic in the campaign that's not just kind of the same thing every day. And so I feel like there's been a lot of desire to like push the narrative of a Warren surge, and it's sort of like 50% true and 50% false.
What does that mean? What does 50% true mean?
I think it means that if I can interpret,
yes,
it
means Nate's up as interpreter. Claire Malone will now tell us what 50% true means.
It means that there is evidence on the ground via like polling numbers that she is, you know, she had, as we all probably know, a rocky start with the Native American controversy. I think she's putting a lot of effort into early states. She campaigns a lot. I think that's sort of an indisputable thing. She is out there a lot. She's a very visible presence. You know, she has these little moments that go like semi-viral. But I also think that we have to know that media stories, particularly at big outlets, can confer status or confer momentum outsized to the, you know, the polling numbers or the surge. So when someone reads a headline that says war and surging, they don't know that it's, as Nate has laid out, a fluctuations of percentage points, you know, small movements on, in the scale. Do you kind of see it as like, oh, you see, I think people tend to think of, you know, like a wide sweep, a surging narrative. Like, that's how people think about these races.
Right, but wouldn't we, if Trump's approval went, you know, up a few points and then down a couple points,
we'd probably say,
it's pretty much remaining stable.
I think,
can you not say the same about Elizabeth Warren?
I think a surge is the wrong term to describe it. So if you pin me down and say, is she surging or not, I would say no. However, I think she is in a stronger position in the polls than she was a couple of months ago, in a way that's pretty meaningful.
Incremental gains,
and are maybe more lasting anyway, right? So it's kind of like, you know, I would tell to like a Warren voter, is she surging? No, but you have nothing to worry about yet because she does making important incremental gains, and she's starting to win the voters that she would need to win. Look, you could make an argument that after Biden, she is the second strongest candidate positioned to win the primary. You could make that argument for other people too. Bernie certainly can make that argument. Harris, maybe Buttigieg. But she is now in that conversation in that tier. We call it tier 1B or 1C or whatever, right?
If Biden's you do tier 1B or 1C,
as everyone calls it.
No one else does.
And if you look at the polls in Iowa, I mean, I wish we had more Iowa polls. They're probably more useful than these national polls, right? But like, you know, that poll in Iowa showing Biden at 24% and then three candidates, one of whom is Warren at 15%. And Kamala Harris, okay, maybe Iowa's not her best state, but at 7% with good favorables. And then that's kind of a tier of like five candidates. And like, I don't know, maybe that's the race we're going to get. And any of those five could probably win. But compare that to when she launched. And so all the other candidates in that group of five have gotten their surge at some point, right? I think both Bernie and especially Biden, as we talked about, had a bigger surge in the polls than people expected. Maybe they should have expected it, but still, they got very positive coverage for periods of time. Buttigieg, of course, had his surge, which came after he had announced, but still, he became the dominant storyline for a couple of fleeting weeks.
Does Aesop's fable play in here? Slow and steady wins the race?
There is a slow and steady,
the tortoise,
yeah,
in the hare?
Well, there's also like a comeback story, right? I mean, part of what you were saying is that when Elizabeth Warren first announced, there was like a flood of negative coverage about her DNA test and Native American ancestry. And now the media gets to tell perhaps a little bit of a comeback story based on like the force of her ideas. It's also worth saying that Dhrumil Mehta, our colleague here at 538, who's a database journalist, looks at cable news coverage from week to week in the Democratic primary race. And Elizabeth Warren was the second most discussed candidate 2 weeks ago. And she was also the second most discussed candidate last week. And that's second to Biden, of course, both weeks. So she has moved up significantly in cable news coverage.
Yeah, there's this weird kind of meme that, oh, the media is ignoring Elizabeth Warren or getting really negative coverage. I think she gets really friendly coverage recently, in part because, you know, all these people who are harumph, harumph, the horse race is overrated. It should be about policy. And so,
all those terrible people who think the race should be about policy.
And so, harumph, harumph, oh, finally, substance is winning out in the primary. So all those scoldy journalists love it when you can. Who is very substantive, for sure, and is very detailed. I think there are ways, by the way, to be substantive without necessarily having a 50-page proposal for everything, right? I think it's kind of like the Buttigieg kind of, okay, philosophically, we're very deep. We can make fun of that too, right? But, you know.
Or we can.
Claire, what were you going to say?
I said we could not. I mean, I think that, I don't know. Nate, you should finish your thought. But the fact that Warren and Buttigieg are grouped together is so interesting to me always because people kind of, they're like the smart candidates, right? They're the smarty pants. But they are actually quite different in what they present. I mean,
they are.
Warren does have detail,
a plan,
and Buttigieg often does not, or has more of a vague sense of things.
Yeah, the other reason, if you look at that group of four major contenders to Biden, I'm sorry to Beto and Amy and Corey, but you guys are off the lead lap now.
Like Elizabeth Warren, they can have their comeback stories told at some point over the next
and they probably will. I mean, this is kind of like it's June 2019.
will have many twists and turns. And you can, again, find examples of candidates like John Kerry and John McCain, who come to mind right away, and Barack Obama, who all had moments early on where people were saying, this is not going very well, and they win their nomination. So it's really early. But, like, of those four, I think she in some ways formulates the cleanest contrast to Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. And so it's maybe not a coincidence that she has moved up when other candidates have struggled. So, you know, if, for example, you were to have like a Bernie versus Biden race, first of all, there are some Democrats who are not going to be happy with having two 70-something white men to pick from. That's one problem, right? And I think there is actually probably enough space where Bernie is too far left for some Democrats and Biden is too much of a moderate. There is kind of a lot of space there. So I don't know. I think she, I mean, Kamala Harris also forms a contrast to Biden. But the fact that Biden, as we talked about in the first segment, is seen as so transactional and that Warren is seen as so kind of purely motivated by her intellectual belief in this kind of regulated type of capitalism she believes in, whatever else, right? So that formulates a nice contrast that I think she can play off of, where she actually is kind of, she probably has overlap with some Mayor Pete voters. I think she definitely has overlap with some Bernie voters and some Harris voters, but yeah.
Yeah, she's establishment.
So let me ask the kind of second part of this narrative. One is that she's surging or breaking through. The other is that it's based on her policy ideas. Have we seen, I mean, is there a way to tell why she is making these incremental improvements? Like, is there reporting that we've seen that's like, yeah, voters are really into her policy ideas, that's why she's moving up incrementally? Is that just an assumption? Because, yeah, she does come out with a lot of policy proposals, so that must just be why. Is it pure media narrative?
Well, Nate was saying before that paying attention to early state polls is in some ways a good tell. So the fact that she's doing pretty well in Iowa maybe can be interpreted as, listen, people there are seeing her a lot. They're liking her, I guess, digital imprint with the plans, that she is maybe overcoming initial stereotypes, that she is Hillary Clinton redux only in the sense that she is a baby boomer generation white woman, but that she actually has, perhaps people are, I guess, knowing her better, right? Or, and maybe saying like, oh, okay, like attuned Democratic primary early state voters are sort of saying like, okay, maybe she's, I liked Bernie in Iowa in 2016. She seems to have a lot of the same views that he does, but with like a little less strife with the Democratic Party. And then maybe I'm feeling like stirring up less strife within the Democratic Party because it's 2019 and I don't want Donald Trump to win.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Iowa polls are generally a pretty reliable tell for how well you're doing in retail campaigning among high information voters. Also, again, if you look at polls of, if they literally say, are you paying a lot of attention to the campaign? Quinnipiac has begun to ask that question. Then Warren tends to overperform with high information, high interest, I should say, voters.
And so that means, can we tell from that it's really like, you know, the Elizabeth Warren has all of these plans that's kind of giving her a modest boost?
So I don't know. I think, like I said, the policy substance thing is a way often to signal to party activists and the media that, hey, I'm serious and substantive and I've thought about all these problems. And then that might lead party activists and the media to portray her in a more favorable light. I mean, certainly, look, a lot of voters are kind of getting like one or two pieces of information attached to each candidate, right? And so for Warren, the one thing they used to hear was, oh, DNA test Pocahontas. Now they're hearing, oh, she's substantive on policy.
She also, I feel like this has been overlooked because the recent, like, I guess, media narrative has been, oh, it's her policy ideas. She was the first Democratic candidate to say we should impeach Trump based on the Mueller report. You know, she's had these moments where she has kind of grabbed the news cycle by the horns, balls, whatever, yeah, and sort of been like, this is the position. And she was, I mean, frankly, the pace horse for the rest of the candidates. You saw after she made that initial statement about Mueller report and impeachment, you saw people, some of them 3 or 4 days later, come out and say, yeah, 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 that. And I do think that given the Democratic electorate's particular attention to the Mueller report and impeachment and talking over that question, she has some bona fides as far as that particular issue and just being really out in front. And so it's not just the policy issues or, you know, the incremental rise of the policy issues, that she did have a bit of a splashy
right
Mueller report surge. I mean, surge, incremental gain.
Let me give a couple pieces of, in the interest of robust debate, a couple of pieces of things that are not going as well for Warren yet in the data. One is that She is actually not polled all that well in New Hampshire, which you would think would be a good state for her, although there haven't really been very
given
many
its
recent
proximity
polls in
to
New Hampshire.
Massachusetts.
Yeah, and also both Iowa and New Hampshire are white and liberal, or at least their primary electorates and caucus electorates are liberal. So therefore, for candidates like Sanders and Warren, it would be pretty essential to do well in those states. So there haven't been a lot of polls in New Hampshire recently, but she's only broken 10% in one recent poll there. She also has not gotten very many endorsements yet, so she is fifth in endorsement points behind Biden, Booker, Harris, and Klobuchar, although no one except sort of Biden really has all that many. But one thing that could happen is if you start to see progressive groups say, hey, it's Warren and not Bernie, like that might be interesting and might help her by a few points potentially. But you haven't kind of seen big organized efforts by influential groups yet to do things like that.
The other thing is fundraising, right? I mean, at least in the last quarter, she was in fundraising numbers. This was before Biden announced by O'Rourke, Buttigieg, Warren, and Sanders.
Yeah, and I think there, you know, she had a campaign finance director quit in part because he said you need to take some money from large donors that you cannot. That person disagreed with her theory that you can rely on purely small donor donations, you know, which I think I don't know yet. Right. I don't know yet. We're going to find out in 2019 if you can, you know, probably run a pretty tight budget campaign, but still rely just on online donations. Yeah, maybe that's true. And maybe keeping the purity factor helps her. But that shift in fundraising, just the shift in the mechanics of the American presidential campaign, I think we are in a different moment. And it's going to be interesting this election, particularly with the number of candidates in the race, some of whom are trying to do what she's doing, to see what happens. We should note that, like, you know, people like Harris, obviously Biden, like a lot of these other Buttigieg, a lot of these candidates that are doing pretty well in the polls, they're taking big donor money. You know, they're bundling. Just as, you know, Democratic candidates have done for election cycles through most of the modern era.
Nate, you were saying previously that one place where Elizabeth Warren does do well is amongst high information voters.
Yeah.
And in looking at past primaries, is that like a leading indicator of where the primary is headed? What does that signify?
I mean, that question hasn't been asked that often, I don't think, or at least we don't have it in our archives. I would think almost by definition, though, it's a leading indicator, and people forget how few voters are actually really paying attention to the campaign and how few voters have firmly decided upon a candidate. And so, again, you know, also looking at those favorable ratings improving on her behalf, I think, is another kind of positive sign. Yeah. But I think it's like kind of a definition of like a leading indicator in some ways. And it's both because like they're the ones paying attention, so they kind of reflect how voters will see her later on. And there's like a little bit of a comeback story where because she kind of had that poor first impression that she made, that's maybe why you have the especially large gap between voters who think of Elizabeth Warren as, oh, she is the most substantive candidate, I have a plan for that, versus they think, oh, Elizabeth Warren is Pocahontas. And so it kind of works at both ends a little bit where you know, and also, too, like, obviously, you know, college-educated voters, I mean, this is kind of one of the issues a little bit with, like, her media coverage is that kind of media preferences tend to reflect what college-educated voters think, because people in the media are overwhelmingly college-educated now. So that's a bias that you might have to correct for a little bit. But again, the fact that it's not just college-educated voters, but also high-information voters, to me kind of paints that a bit differently. And the fact that you've seen her now doing well in this kind of one Iowa poll. And with the fundraising, like, I would be surprised if she doesn't see her numbers improve a lot in the second quarter that we're in now. She's always fundraised really well for her like Senate campaigns, which she didn't really need to, frankly, had like excess money. So it was a bit surprising she did kind of poorly before. If that doesn't go well, then frankly, I do think that would shift my prior back to saying, okay, maybe this is like a little bit of a thing where kind of the media bubble is getting this wrong. There's no reason why she shouldn't have pretty good fundraising numbers. And I think she probably will. I mean, those will kind of come out kind of after the first debate a couple days after, where it will be the end of the quarter, and the campaigns will, depending on how excited they are about those numbers, kind of time the release of those numbers. So you can imagine a scenario where she does well in a debate and she gets very positive coverage. You can also imagine a case where, I mean, I don't know.
By the way, just to note, because we were talking about significance of early state polls and campaigning, Warren hired Bernie Sanders' caucus director for Iowa. And I believe she also has on her staff Hillary Clinton, one of Hillary Clinton's top Iowa people. So perhaps that's an indication of they're aggressively going after that state. They have people who really know the rules of that state, who know the particularities of that state, even though we know that the Democratic, the DNC is trying to make non, you know, white states also sing in the primaries. But like Iowa remains a very important place, and that key hires and people who know how the particular politics of that state work are important, and Warren seems to have those people.
Yeah, and she has a fairly robust, expensive team.
Yeah, I think she spent the most money of anybody on staff in Iowa.
Yeah. Which I think is smart. I think, like, I mean, candidates should be concerned about their burn rate, right? But, like, look, if you get to the point where you can't support a staff, then you probably are not going to win the nomination anyway. And so it's kind of like, why not
go out and see what happens?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what Scott Walker did, and then he was the first person to drop out. But
what?
I guess he found out he found out relatively early if it was going to work. So, okay, as we wrap up talking about things that Elizabeth Warren is spending money on, like staff in Iowa, one thing that she's kind of let be known through the press, I guess I read this in the Washington Post, she has not hired a traditional pollster.
Oh, God.
So that's your reaction. I guess, does this just
what
get
is that?
Into...
Sorry, I actually didn't see that. What does that mean?
So,
well,
she just says
data and insights team, right? And they're like, well...
So she doesn't have, like, a top pollster that's, like, the figurehead.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I can't tell you exactly what that means, but... Does that just get at this desire to be viewed as kind of authentic and driven by
probably
kind of heart?
Do you know who said that a lot during 2016?
Donald Trump.
Yes.
It probably polls pretty well to not hire a pollster. I mean, because the funny thing is about
Warren. We should poll it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should poll that.
Would you prefer a candidate
who has a traditional pollster or who does? It would probably
and she
be
has
overwhelming.
Like a, she has like an analytics team
poster.
And that obviously kind of gets a little squirrely kind of what she is or not doing, right? But like, look. I don't think Warren is taking very many positions that are, like, unpopular, or at least unpopular with the Democrats that she needs to, like, with the Democrats that she needs to win over, right? So call it, like, the leftmost half, two-thirds of the electorate. Maybe she's not going to win over the Democrats that call themselves conservative or something, right? But she's taking, you know, a case like impeachment. Her stance is the popular stance in the Democratic primary, and it's kind of surprising that more candidates weren't more eager to do something like that sooner. And so it's like, I'm not quite sure, like, what she's sacrificing in order to, like, you know, be more substantive or whatever. I mean, I do think that one weird flaw is that she doesn't have her own health care plan, unless I'm mistaken, and she's basically just kind of endorsed Bernie Sanders' plan, as several candidates have. I mean, to me, that's like a big win for Bernie. And a little bit surprising that she hasn't tried to come up with her own plan, or maybe something that, like, you know, that would try to blend, I don't know, somewhere in between a public option and Medicare for all. Maybe you can't really do that. I don't know. But that's kind of surprising.
But maybe that's like a, because, yeah, I mean, I think all the senators in the race right now have endorsed the Sanders plan. So maybe that's sort of like an internal consensus that should this ever become a viable option, we don't want to waste time squabbling with each other. We want to work from the same template. I don't know.
All right. Well, just to finally close out, we are, you know, still, we're only halfway through the year. There hasn't been a ton of movement in the polls, although we've seen kind of like bumps for people here and there and incremental rises, as we've discussed. What, looking forward, are going to be the set pieces that we should be looking to see if Elizabeth Warren really takes off, or if Buttigieg really takes off, or Biden, you know, becomes
what
a
are
clear,
the pseudo events?
What are the pseudo events?
Debates. It's also big news cycle events, right? Like what? Like if there's a major move by the Trump administration, like let's say if the Trump, let me bring up topical bingo here. If Trump had actually imposed tariffs on Mexico, and like a true like international economic incident started, maybe that would become an event in the campaign, right? But I think I think from now on, what's weird about presidential campaigns is it's stops along the way, like the debates, like, oh, everyone's in Iowa this weekend to eat butter. But then it's also how do they handle the curveballs that the news and world events hand them, right? Like how do they respond to
Right, like 2008, Trump that was huge. Yeah. Like a huge part of the campaign.
Absolutely. Yeah. What Galen is talking about is that the financial crash basically happened in the last month and a half of the campaign.
And it was like Russia also going into Georgia. I feel like there were actually so many little crises that happened where like Katie Kirk's asking Sarah Palin about like the president of Georgia.
Well, the big thing in 2008 was that John McCain said he was going to stop campaigning and go back to Washington to concentrate on the financial crisis. And Barack Obama was like, I can do both at the same time, which was, as it turned out, a savvy flex, although that was, I think, not a laughing matter. It was like a terrible time in the world economy and for a lot of people. But that, obviously, I think Obama had been ahead in the polls for a while. And
you know, why that got kind of spun into a big negative for McCain is interesting and has to do with media cycles and everything else. I mean, the other thing I'm looking for is the thing I mentioned briefly earlier, which is, are you going to start to see big Democratic groups such as labor unions, as well as all these people we track as individual endorsers, senators and governors or whatnot, are they going to start to weigh in a more robust way than they have so far? You know, you see a lot of people saying, well, we were kind of almost ready to do this, and then someone else was surging and we weren't quite sure. We're going to kind of keep our powder fairly dry. You know, by the way, I think the other candidate we've not talked about very much is Kamala Harris, and trying to figure out, like, is she coming or going or you know, I don't know.
All right, well, we are going to leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room, and I want to welcome our new intern, Jake Arlo. She'll be with us for the summer, and we've got some exciting stuff planned that she'll be helping us with, so look out for that. You can also get in touch by emailing us at podcast@538.com. Or you can, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon.